be after drawing out all his hard-earned cash.
And we're back. Miracle of miracles. This is CIUT. It's a Taylor Report. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. And joining us, I believe, is Tony Lee of Local 222, Unifor, Oshawa, General Motors. Are you there?
I am, Phil.
You have such a big title. It's kind of, you know, I had to go through all this. Okay. Unifor is having a convention in August.
Yes.
When is it, and how important is it in your view?
It's extremely important in my view. August 8th to 12th is the Constitutional Convention of Unifor. It's held every 3 years. The top leadership of the union are elected there, which is normally just a coronation. But this time there's an active campaign going on, and that's thanks to, in large part, Dave Cassidy, the president of Local 444, who said he wasn't going to accept the leadership picking the next president, that he was going to put his name forward and campaign. And that has upset the whole apple cart to a great degree. Mm-hmm. And it's opened up at least the possibility for members to have their say on a whole lot of issues, including, of course, the number one issue, which is the investigation into the corruption that the former president, Jerry Dias, was involved in.
Mm-hmm. What is the status of that? We've spoken to you before, and of course I'm interested in how the candidates, such as they are, address this, but there was a report that in the media, where it starts for me, that the Jerry Dias had shared some money with somebody in the leadership there in an inappropriate way, and this led to apparently his decision to see a doctor about some problems he had. So there was, and I heard that the police were involved. So where are we with that? What did the union do? Do we have any knowledge of the police?
Of course. The Globe and Mail had one of the great headlines of all time, talking about the bag of cash and bottles of cologne. Mm-hmm. And apparently Jerry was handing over a bag with $25,000 in cash in it to one of his assistants. And that is what was being investigated. It's also much later was turned over to the Toronto police to also investigate. We haven't heard. The police said that they were investigating it, but we haven't heard anything about their investigation since. Mm-hmm. And the union engaged a private firm to conduct an investigation internally into what had happened. There's a lot of questions about that because they haven't revealed the firm, the name of the firm, so we don't know who did the investigation. We haven't seen the report of that investigation, although we've heard, you know, some snippets from it. We were promised a week ago by the acting leader of Unifor, Lana Payne, that it was going to be released to Unifor members, but I haven't seen it yet. And a lot of people would like to see it. And the other thing that's really critical that we don't know is who was supplying the money. Apparently, it's a supplier of COVID test kits that Jerry Dias used his influence as president of the union to get companies that the union bargains with to buy those test kits, which certainly, on the face of it, sounds corrupt or like bribery.
Yeah, sort of a faint hint there.
But we don't know the name of that company. We don't know the name of the companies that purchased the kits. So there's a lot of really important information that we don't have yet.
Well, and when you say, the companies that sold, the company that purchased, or the amounts, I mean,
right.
if two bags of money were seen, or I guess one large bag got divided somehow, but given the amount, it suggests that maybe somebody was profiting fairly good numbers. wouldn't
yes.
it?
Yes. That's certainly an important factor, how much money did change hands.
I'm surprised the media isn't interested in the police side of it. You would think they would be asking, okay, so are you investigating? Who are you investigating?
Mm-hmm. You know? But as you mentioned...
That's why I played Mac the Knife, I think. Go ahead.
Well, and that was very appropriate, in my opinion. You mentioned one of the important factors, which is that once he realized that this was going to be talked about publicly, which wasn't initially, I mean, the investigation into Dias started before the end of January of this year. But it wasn't until near the middle of March, once the Globe and Mail was on the scent, that Jerry realized it was going to become public. And at that point, he had his lawyer commission a medical report from somebody who apparently is considered a forensic psychiatrist, whatever that is.
A new category.
To send a letter saying, sorry, Unifor, Jerry is not able to participate in the investigation, and he has to check into some sort of rehab. And since then, we haven't seen or heard from Jerry. We haven't seen the report. And as far as I know, the actual hearing into the charges against Jerry has not been held yet.
Oh, this is so striking. Now, you say there was a report was promised and is on, you know, they said what? Very shortly, or they used some phrase about very soon.
As soon as possible.
But what about, are people going to, is it members of Unifor expecting that there will be an election without that report? Without seeing it? Because that report is going to talk about some of these people running for the office, right?
Absolutely. It talks about, in particular, the one person who's running to replace Jerry, who was handpicked by Jerry. His name is Scott Doherty. So, yes, the members want to see that report before the election. Certainly the delegates to the convention, who are the ones who actually get to vote, I'm sure would all like to see that report. And all I've seen so far is one paragraph of it that somebody floated around. And, I can't verify that it's
alleged
authentic.
Yeah,
but
alleged
it looks
paragraph
authentic.
From the report, yeah.
And it's interesting because it talks about Scott Doherty, who was Jerry's main assistant. Jerry had 5 or 6 or 7 assistants. I'm not exactly sure. But Scott Doherty was like the number one guy who was always with Jerry and was chosen by him to be his successor. And Jerry went to the National Executive Board, the top leadership body of Unifor, back on February the 1st and asked them to endorse Scott Doherty. And he did that even though at the time he was under investigation for the bag of cash.
No, I should probably ask you, he knew he was under investigation, right?
Yes, he had been told before that.
And he made a recommendation for leader while being...
Yes, he did.
Without a declared position, yay or nay, as to the charges or the things being investigated.
What I have read, if it's accurate, is that though the members of the National Executive Board at that point were not aware of the charges.
Mm-hmm.
So all they knew was, here's the president saying, I want you to endorse this guy, Scott Doherty, which they did. And Scott Doherty, by the way, was pleased as punch. He immediately changed his Twitter bio. I got a picture of it here. It's gone now, but I didn't find it.
Things are disappearing. Yeah.
Well, you know how those things work.
Yes.
Scott Doherty, candidate for national president of Unifor, endorsed by Unifor's National Executive Board.
Ah.
And I found another tweet from back in February where he said, thank you, Noreen Ritzvi and Shanae, whoever that is, for inviting me to speak with the Ontario Regional Council exec today as the NEB, and it's bolded, NEB endorsed candidate for national president of UNIFOR. So he thought
data, what's the date on that word? I'm being very forensic here.
Yeah, that was February 17th. So that was 16 days after he got the endorsement.
He knew something about the bag of money, right, at that point.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The bag of money apparently was handed over to another assistant of Jerry's on at some point in December or January. I'm not exactly sure. It's not clear to me what the date was, but well, it must have been in January, actually, because we were told that the person receiving the bag of money then had to think about what to do about it,
yes.
Consulted with Noreen Ritzvie, the Ontario director, and in the course of the next 6 days, had several discussions with Scott Doherty. And so Scott Doherty was in on sitting and looking at a bag with $25,000 cash in it and trying to decide what to do about it for 6 days.
During which he talked to Doherty.
Doherty was talking to the person who received the money. His name is Chris McDonald. And we don't know who else they were talking to, but at the end of the 6 days, Chris McDonald filed a complaint. Now, what's interesting is this little...
After 6 days thinking, that's what he did.
Yeah, thinking, talking, you know.
Don't jump to conclusions.
No, wait, I mean...
Measure nine times and cut once.
What do you do when you have a bag with $25,000 in cash?
I would have trouble sitting in the same room with that bag and thinking. I would say, so, no, close the door on the bag, okay? I'm trying to think. It's yours, Phil. Come on. It's yours.
I just recently came across this paragraph that apparently is from the investigation into this incident, and it looks authentic to me, but this is what it says. It says that Doherty was not a particularly cooperative witness. It took three attempts to get him to attend for his interview, and on both of the first two scheduled dates, he canceled at the last minute or simply didn't show up and only advised afterward that he'd been tied up. The investigator asked Doherty by letter.
Who tied him up?
The investigator asked Doherty by letter dated February 10th to forward a list of relevant documents to her. He was reminded several times, and in his eventual interview on February 28th, 2022, he agreed to do so. But as of the time of filing of this report, Doherty has not shared any documents. When asked about text, Signal, and WhatsApp messages, which he might have and would be relevant, Doherty advised that he doesn't use WhatsApp and that he deletes all his text and Signal messages. Given that according to other credible evidence, text and Signal are the regular mode of communication between leadership at UNIFOR, the investigator has a hard time believing Doherty's explanation that he deletes all such communication. It is more likely that Doherty deleted some of his texts and Signal messages, or just those that might somehow implicate Dias or show that Doherty and Dias were in communication about the complaint when Dias was specifically told not to be, and that Dias was using Doherty to exert pressure on McDonald on Dias's behalf.
That is alleged to be part of this report?
Yes, I'm reading from a picture that claims to be part of the report, yes.
I think the members ought to have a look at this. By the way, do they promise it for the members, or who gets to see it?
Lana Payne, who is one of the other candidates for national president, said that it was going to be released to all members of UNIFOR and was going to be sent to the local unions, presumably as a way to make it available to members. But I haven't seen it yet. I don't know if my local union has it or not, but...
Have the, or is it settled as to who's attending? I mean, are all the votes in as to who gets to go to the convention? How many people ordinarily go to the Unifor convention?
Pretty much. There should be about 2,000 delegates.
Wow.
The deadline for registration is July 22nd, but I think at this point that it's fair to presume that all of the locals have already elected their delegates.
You know, and we're speaking to Tony Leah, Local 222. By the way, there is a blog. Is it Spot? Solonet.net, is that right?
Solonet.ca.
.ca. Solonet.ca. There's a lot of interesting material there, but in order to understand this, but
there's some good pictures there. That one of them
when
includes
people always when you're telling news, most of us like to see the pictures. So at your site, I congratulate you. It satisfies my interest in that regard.
We have some nice pictures of Jerry Dias. And also Scott Doherty. It's under the tab that's called Rogues Gallery.
Hmm. That's odd. Now, you say there's a campaign, but are they really campaigning? I mean, are they? My idea of campaigning is that they're putting their 10-point program and listing their endorsements, but my impression is they're fairly quiet.
Well, no, there is a campaign going on. Doherty and Lana Payne in particular have been trying very hard to get endorsements from local unions and have been publicizing the ones they get. The third candidate, Dave Cassidy, has issued a number of statements and videos and has put less emphasis on listing endorsements. His pitch is that he is the representative of the membership, and that the membership should take back the union. So he's putting less emphasis on leadership or staff endorsements. To me personally, I find it offensive when paid staff of the union are out endorsing and telling people who they think should be the next president who's going
to
be there.
Just to be clear, they're in another union, aren't they?
Well, they have their own independent union, yes.
So they're campaigning in Unifor.
They're campaigning very hard about who's going to be their next boss, frankly, which I think is a conflict of interest.
Sounds like one. But we're all so litigious. But if I had, if one had deep pockets, you could say, listen, you can't. Their union should say, we don't want to get involved in this.
Yeah. I'll read you a comment. This is from a Unifor member. Who is from Local 2301 in Kitimat, B.C., represents the Alcan smelter workers there. His name is Cliff Madsen. He posted this publicly, so I think it's fair to read it. Part of his statement is, the senior staff supporting Scott, that's Doherty, are actually the worst indicator of who the best candidate for president is. It's those at the top thinking they know better than our membership.
Yeah, I would. That, by the way, isn't that you're a labor historian as well as being 222 political action, et cetera. That's a common complaint about contemporary unionism is that the staff have become the creature, sort of like, almost in a parasitic role on the actual members.
Well, sure. The national representatives of Unifor, and there's somewhere like 150 or 200 of them, I don't know the exact number, between their salaries and their car allowances and their expenses, all make more than $150,000 a year. And that, of course, comes from the dues of the members.
That's almost as much as the ordinary Unifor guard makes.
Well, in fact, this figure has been published. The average member of Unifor makes less than $25 an hour, which is less than $50,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So their national representatives are making three times as much. I think it's completely out of whack.
Right across the board, that is a complaint that this idea of entitlement has taken hold.
Entitlement.
very deeply.
One of the,
by the way, do they address this? I mean, does Cassidy address that kind of thing? He's the guy who represents a union, I mean, a local.
I think that he has, talked about transparency and representation of the members and working for the members in general terms, but he has not been pointed about talking to directly to some of these key issues. But I will say that one of the great things about having an actual campaign is that it has stirred a lot of interest from members of the union. And if you look through the list of resolutions that have been submitted to the convention, you can see that members in different locals have really started thinking about what they would like to see the union do and what they would like to see in the leadership. And so when I look through the list of resolutions, there's a resolution calling for the union to reaffiliate to the Canadian Labour Congress, because that would enhance the unity of the labor movement in this country. I think that's a really important point. There's a resolution from Local 88, which represents the workers at Cammy Automotive. It's basically a GM plant in Ingersoll, calling for one member, one vote, that the leadership of Unifor should be elected directly by all the members of Unifor. There are resolutions calling for getting rid of the two-tier system and going back to equal wages and pensions, which is a fundamental union principle. There's a resolution calling for publishing the expense money that goes to the assistants and top officers of the union, so there would be more transparency. There's a resolution saying that the members of the National Executive Board shouldn't endorse a candidate and shouldn't campaign for a candidate. They should leave that up to the local unions. So there's a lot of interesting resolutions that have been brought forward because things have been opened up a little bit, and it's got people thinking about how the union should be run.
There's also kind of an important resolution given the inflationary period which we are dramatically being dumped at the moment about pensions.
Well, that's right. That resolution was endorsed by my local 222, and our local retired workers chapter as well. And it points out that in the auto sector, and I think in probably other sectors as well, but particularly in the auto sector, retired workers have not had an increase in their pension since 2007. In five consecutive collective agreements, there's been zero increase in pensions. So people who retired 15 or 20 or 25 years ago have had the purchasing power of their pension reduced up to today by 35.5%. That's what they've lost, because the previous policy that the union followed of always increasing pensions stopped in 2007. And by the way, that's the same time that our union bought into the two-tier system of having lower wages for new hires and eliminating them from the pension plan.
And wasn't that the ideology involved was that we have to save our companies and do our part, tighten our belts the way the bosses are tightening their belts? We all have to do this. And the ones in the helmet in the mud fighting.
The ideology, yes, the ideology exactly is of cooperation with the companies, team concept. It's paid off big time for corporations like GM, which have never made more profits in their over 100-year history. But meanwhile, they are paying less in wages.
Something connected. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
They might be connected. In 2007, the starting rate, if somebody was hired at GM or one of the auto companies in 2007, they started at $28.82 an hour. And that was in 2007 dollars, which are worth more than today's dollars. Today, if you get hired at GM or one of the other auto companies, you start at 23 67.
Whoa. Did he give you that in a bag?
And there's no bottle of cologne.
I could see these resolutions, why they would be coming in. What do you think about their prospects of actually getting a decent debate or being passed? And do they become, if they pass them, do they have to be implemented?
I don't know what the prospects are. I wish I was a delegate, to be honest. Hopefully people will speak to these things. And if they are passed, of course, that would just be the very initial step, because then there would have to be a strong campaign to get bargaining committees elected who are committed to these principles and then are willing to take on corporations and fight it out. One of the things that resolution points out, which I think is very important, is that it's not just a question of bargaining, but it's also a question of legislation. And in Quebec, employers can't have different wage scales and different pension plans based on the date that you were hired, because it's against the law. It's against the labor legislation in Quebec. And I wish that the labor movement in this country and that my union publicize that more.
Exactly. Because how are people supposed to understand that's reachable? We're really given to understand in Ontario that such things are just daydreams, you know.
Right.
But if you say, no, wait a minute, we mean fantasizing. They have it in Quebec.
They have it in Quebec because the labor movement in Quebec fought for it.
Mm-hmm. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you. Well, I guess for the last part here, do remind us, Unifor, of course, was and is sort of a cousin of the United Auto Workers in the U.S., it used to be the same union. Then they became Canadian Auto Workers. Then they became what now? Unifor. Meanwhile, the cousins have had their own problems with leaders who couldn't quite account for things. And I think one of them or two, maybe more than one, went to jail. But they have one vote, right?
They do. And it is an interesting history.
Do they seem to like that?
Oh, yes, I would say. I mean, it hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen this year. And it is a result of the corruption coming to light and being investigated and prosecuted. In fact, there were 12 top leaders of the UAW who were indicted, pled guilty, and sentenced to jail terms, including two former international presidents of the UAW. And, of course, they did the same as Unifor did when it started. They said, oh, it's just an isolated incident. And then it was another person. And then it was another. And then it was another. Hmm. And eventually, because it was pursued rather rigorously by the federal authorities in the United States, the union agreed to a consent decree that said, as part of dealing with this corruption that had been uncovered, that they would move to a system of one member, one vote. Or, in fact, they agreed to put it to a referendum of the membership. And hundreds of thousands of UAW members voted, and they voted very strongly in favor of one member, one vote. And so that system will now be implemented.
You know, if your convention were to pass that, that would be a good idea. Let's put this to the members.
Absolutely, it would. Yes. Yes.
Pardon me?
Yes, I would love to see that.
Because then you'd say, well, this is what we've decided to do.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, at the end of this, and by the way, it's certainly apropos of what I want to ask you next, is that the members then become engaged because they say, I'm looking at these candidates. Who are these guys? I know that's my starting point. Who are these?
Well, that's right. Sure. And a lot of people are saying that, you know. The different candidates are posting things here and there. And one of the comments that's almost always there is, how do I get to vote on this?
Yes.
Well, sorry, you don't.
You don't. Yes. We have a monarchy. Yeah. That leads me to a matter I want to ask you about. We start at the top of the show, we mentioned Alex Tourelle, the Green Party leader of Quebec, longstanding Green Party leader. You've met Mr. Tourelle, I understand, and he's having some difficulty. They're saying he can't stand for leader of the Green Party federal because he is he's brought them into disrepute for his views on NATO and Ukraine. But I'm arguing he did a lot for the reputation of the Green Party when he came to Oshawa. Could you talk about him and that?
Yes, he did. Alex is a very principled, very smart political leader. I think he's been leader of the Green Party of Quebec for 9 years. And in the previous leadership campaign, at the beginning of it, he put his name forward. And while he was going around the country campaigning, he made a point of stopping in Oshawa. And that's when we were fighting against the closure or the end of vehicle production by General Motors in Oshawa. And he came and met with some of the people from Green Jobs Oshawa who were fighting against that closure. And he stood in front of the GM plant in Oshawa, and he gave a public statement saying that he agreed with Green Jobs Oshawa that the answer to the problem in Oshawa was for the federal government to bring that operation under public ownership and transition to electric vehicles or public transit vehicles that would not only provide jobs, but also make a significant contribution to dealing with the climate crisis. And that was very courageous of him, and it was great solidarity. And, you know, we've paid close attention to Alex since then.
Yeah. Well, I hope all those folks who saw him and appreciated his coming there will note this and send the Green Party a little message saying, you need a guy like this.
Well, at the very least, let him run. Let the members decide. This is such a travesty.
Well, if you let the members decide, where do you get, what are the executive going to do for a living? I mean, you know,
because they're supposed
to decide.
There's no headlines anymore in the papers except talking about democracy, democracy, democracy. We're you know, enforcing democracy by bombing this place or that place. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to actual democracy and letting the members decide, all of a sudden, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, for Borton. Well, Tony Leah, Local 222, this is a really, you're involved in a lot of important stories, and we're coming, the time is short for that convention, so we look forward to talking to you some more about this.
Be happy to, Phil.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tony Leah, I think we might have some music. We do.